What is there to review when it comes to a Miley Cyrus album? Her singing affected and perfected by software? How her powerless pop makes you feel deep down in your quivering soul? How to rate this latest iteration of her personae, codenamed Strategic Hot Mess, to address these complex matters of cultural ownership with a post-teen girl who has belonged to the public her whole life? A simulacrum of childhood turned into one of the great products of our age, a bigger emblem of the empire than Mickey Mouse himself. What else could she do but nuke it, saturate herself in our greedy gaze until she dissolves, give it all away, turn herself out until our knowledge of her is borderline gynecological? Is there a part of Mickey that remains unknown? Did you really expect an album called Bangers to reveal anything to you? In knowing everything, we find we know nothing. The entertainment value of Cyrus's work is more than simply typical pop pleasure. It is the slow-motion horror of watching toxic sleaze replace toxic purity. At her extremes, she firmly engaged our most puritanical mores, from saccharine virgin to knowingly fellatiating a sledgehammer. Cyrus is at once both banal and pernicious. Well, that opens an essay from today's book entitled Miley Cyrus Bangers that appeared in Spin Magazine in October of 2013. It's from the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic. Jessica Hopper is her name. And indeed, I think most of us would agree, or at least assent to the assertion, that rock and roll is a man's game, a man's music, a guise to critique. So it has been since the beginnings of rock in the 1950s, all that long ago, at least for most of us. And so the wonder and the delight of reading the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic. Yes, Annie Leibovitz may have hung out with the Stones and photographed them for posterity, but it's Jessica Hopper who has taken up her pen and slammed this book in our face. I'm glad she has. Whether Hopper is exploring the wonder that is pop diva Miley Cyrus, as we've just heard, dissecting the music and meaning of Michael Jackson or Ricky Lee Jones, or delving into the Compton, California, Chicago roots of rapper Kendrick Lamar, she is articulate, pointed, and downright fun to read. Jessica Hopper is, in other words, a worthy critic of this epitome of contemporary culture that we call rock music. Hopper's writing is personal, getting into the lives and the minds of the musicians she talks and writes about. Her writing is snappy and at the same time in-depth, befitting the music and the music scene she knows so well. As she writes from an essay published in the Chicago Reader in 07 titled Not Lollapalooza, Rollin Hunt, Screaming Females, and Abe Vigoda, not the actor, by the way. 2 weeks ago, the posy kidcore band Abe Vigoda brought L.A.'s Evolution summer scene to a pair of Chicago basements. The first night, they shimmified 19 stinky kids and a beer-drunk dog at a party in Pilsen. And the second, they did a last-minute set at People Projects as the token dudes at a Lady Fest benefit, playing for maybe 20 people, half of them festival volunteers. In Pilsen, they kept it short and sweet with 6 songs in less than 15 minutes. Quote, "We've got to make it quick before the cops show back up," end quote, explained guitarist Chatterbox Juan Velasquez. The PA kept feeding back and you couldn't hear the singing, so the band turned off the mics and just shouted along. None of us really knew how the songs went anyway, and everyone was too busy dancing to care. The B-side of Abe Vigoda's recent Animal Ghosts 7-inch, All Night and Day, hasn't left my turntable since I dropped it on. Their tribal funk and sideways funk made for a kind of dance punk nobody else has dreamed up yet, full of jostling guitars that manage to be both precise and playful. Their sound has a kind of cloistered innocence. It knows nothing of disco. Calypso would be more like it, given the deep love these guys have for the woodblock. Abe Vigoda's antecedents are hard for me to pin down. Maybe dub, maybe New Zealand pop, maybe some band they hung out with in Chino that I don't know about. But no matter how you slice it, Their show is a cynicism destroying good time. Well, criticism by a living female rock critic is divided into themes, believe it or not. Themes such as California, real or fake, nostalgia, Chicago, females, faith, strictly business, and a topic I find myself asked why I don't write more of, bad reviews. Providing a rough sense of order, these slam-bang essays in which Hopper grabs us as readers from her first sentence and doesn't let our attention wane until pages later. The mark of a good, indeed a great writer of any genre. This reordering of her writing career obviously shakes up the chronology in which the essays were published, putting the reader's focus on the themes rather than the chronology, which, as you may have noted, runs from the early years of this century to the present day. Note, too, the span of publications in which these essays first appeared. It's wide, both geographically and culturally, running from the West Coast to the East Coast, from North to South, from Spin to the Chicago Reader. Hopper was and is writing for more than a narrow swath of the music world, and that breadth of readers shows in the breadth of the topics she covers. There is a kinetic variety here, variety of rock music, variety of musical experience, and variety of emotion. Jessica Hopper takes us from mainstream pop, Van Morrison, offers us a lot of rap, and throws in a good chunk of punk and indie music as well. Many of the essays collected here are critical reviews of the music she's tuned into and critiques of music Hopper considers important to the cultural world she is writing to. And while many of these essays engage the reader in criticism that is positive in its intent, not all is sweetness and life. The collection of essays found under bad reviews lets us see the flip side of Hopper's cultural tastes. She writes with searing prose of the ever-present Miley Cyrus. Where, oh, where is Justin Bieber, you may opine? And as I have found writing book reviews, when you really, really don't like a book, and I do like this one, or in this case, a musical act, writing a scathing yet thoughtful review is a great way to work out your disappointments. Now, I'll note that I'm not old enough to really understand and groove to the phenomenon that was Nirvana. I do realize the Seattle-based band ushered in the era of grunge rock, and I am a well-versed enough reader to appreciate the delicious hatred that oozes from Jessica Hopper's review of the 2001 re-release four-volume CD set of Nevermind. Hopper takes umbrage at yet another attempt to make money from a rock and roll past. As she writes in part, Nevermind by Nirvana is a great record, but Lord, what a boring thing to offer fans. There's not even any fresh meat for the obsessive who go after this sort of thing. Yes, this bottom-of-the-barrel commemoration also carries wonderful news. There's nothing left to scrape up. The lost tracks, alternate versions, outtakes, live sets, piss takes, and demos have all been packaged and turned out. His former labels have had 17 years to wave those scraps into dollars, and they're clearly diluting what few bits are left in order to make it last. Universal is stacking up the editions of Nevermind for a last hurrah, with not just the Super Deluxe set, but also a two-disc deluxe version and a straight-up single CD remastered reissue of the album. Oh, and you can buy the DVD by itself, too. This is the beginning of the end, though if you squint, you can see the heart-shaped box in an actual box shaped like a heart 25th anniversary box set, and Nevermind in mono, galloping this way on the horizon. My gosh, more searing writing you will rarely find, and more entertaining writing you will rarely find. As one of the tail end of the first generation to grow up with rock and roll as the soundscape of so much of my life, I'm bemused that for Hopper, the chapter titled Nostalgia offers a chance to write about musical acts like Bruce Springsteen and Pearl Jam. Well, let's finish with Hopper's musings on the commercialization of punk music, a musical genre whose core was birthed in a spirit of F this world, With Hopper's pen, we discover that punk has turned into this. From the essay entitled Punk is Dead, Long Live Punk, a report on the state of teen spirit from the mobile shopping mall that is the Vans Warped Tour, Chicago Reader. Teenagers are the most powerful audience in America, and this summer, the Vans Warped Tour celebrated 10 years of unwavering devotion to this principle. At each stop, anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000 teenagers converged, wading deep into the froth of pop cultural commerce that they drive with their fickle tastes. In exchange for the $18 to $30 that is a warped ticket cost, the sunburned throngs get 8 hours and five dozen bands of accessible punk, hardcore, and hip-hop. Yet no impartial observer could conclude that Warped is first and foremost about the music. It's about teenagers and their disposable income. Punk in its primal form is, of course, an anti-commercial genre. But Warped has turned money into the medium of cultural affiliation here, as it already has everywhere else. What's being sold is an entree into punk. And most of the fans are too new to the music's ideals to understand that they're buying a version of F All the Rebellion that's been repackaged by business people. Or maybe they do understand, and they come because they think it's the only version left. Warped is a mammoth shopping and marketing experience, a towering conglomerated product of the Clear Channel age. And though the music is the initial draw, purchases are the way the kids express themselves, to the bands, and to each other. She goes on to write, look no further than the Casualties merch tent, with its 24 t-shirt designs, two styles of handkerchief, and three different hats. A Day at Warped is about kids saying, I love you, to their favorite bands, with cash in hand, on a scale that boggles the mind. We're a long way from the Fireside Bowl, which is the kind of punk dive many Warped acts came up playing, sometimes only 20 or 30 kids at a time. Selling a handful of 7 inches for gas money isn't going to cut it if you're touring as part of an operation that requires a fleet of 10 tractor trailers, 100 tour buses and vans, 11 sound systems, a full-time on-site doctor and massage therapist, and a catering service that can handle two hot meals a day for 650 to 800 people. On July 24, the day Warped stop at the Tweeter Center in Tinley Park, the band Taking Back Sunday grossed $20,000 in t-shirt sales alone. I spent a few weeks on the 2004 Warped Tour among these teenagers. The average age seemed to be 16. I remember 16 is a pretty grim year, for from the safe distance of a decade, 16-year-olds are completely fascinating. I was surrounded by thousands of kids, a rushing tide of adolescent self-concept run riot, of bad tribal tattoos and rapturous infatuations and questionable hairstyles, all reeking of the pungent desire to simultaneously transgress and fit in perfectly. She ends this delightful and searing essay with this. Between songs, the DJ contended with the winter fresh gum camper van 30 feet away, which was staffed by a chipper woman who leapt into the brief lulls in the Mean Reds set to announce via her gummobile's large PA that, quote, fresh breath and fresh music go together, end quote. The DJ glanced hatefully at the truck and passed the mic, interviewing the girls in the front row. What does punk rock mean to you? What is punk rock about for you? A Latina no older than 15, with red-streaked hair and matching red bands on her braces, answered, punk rock is about being who you are and doing what you want. The rest of the small audience clapped. Well, I think you too will enjoy this first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic. You might even get up and clap yourself. It's quite a collection. It's quite a bit of writing. It's available at all of our fine local libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.